quebec.ca/coronavirus. Let's continue to protect ourselves. A message from the gouvernement.
Okay, super. How are you today?
I'm very well.
Excellent.
My name is Julia Eckert. I'm German and I live in Brussels. I'm a viola player and also a programmer at QO2 Workspace, also here in Brussels. At the workspace, I'm making together with my colleagues Carolina and Henry. I'm making the program. We receive the residents, we listen to the residents, and we make research projects from what we hear. As a viola player, I have been classical training. I have done some improvisation also, and since some years now, I am mostly working with composer Elian Radigue, about whom I also made recently a book. Well, I think the interest to sound came via music, because initially, of course, I like to play music, and I think I could even say that I like more to play it than to listen to it. Still today, I do not listen to much music. I guess that step by step, I realized that sound is something that you can ask many questions about, but also something with which you can ask many questions. It's also like a means of research somehow. Like with sound, you can understand many more layers of society or of knowledge or of many things than with intellectual tools, I would say. And I guess that mostly I understood this through working with other people. I think it's mostly other people who showed this to me somehow, that there is more in sound than music. One time I was asked by somebody, what do you like in music? And I think that if I remember back when I was a child, why I liked to play music, I think it's because it was such an organized world. Somehow, then sound, of course, is a totally chaotic thing, actually, which passes on totally other waves than music often.
So do you see them as kind of two different practices? This kind of
sound and music
for you?
Not necessarily, but there's like, it could be somehow. It's two different vantage points, maybe, I would imagine. Also because there is a big difference between, I mean, less and less with technology, but I think there is a difference between listening to music and playing music. I think it has a different benefit for you, for yourself. QO2 was in the beginning a music ensemble, so this was like in the year 1995, when you were probably like 2 years old or something.
Six
years old, you see. Then I was a student, and I was interested in contemporary music, and I wanted to play the music of friends, but I wanted also to discover the sort of those people like Cage and so, you know, like these people who had written, which was already history, but which was still contemporary music. So we were a music ensemble, and more it went in directions of making more projects than just programs, I think. So projects also in collaboration with people from other fields, you know, like for some time, for example, I had a trio with a dancer and a video maker, these sort of things. And then it became more and more the concentration on process and research. And then I think it was just some sort of a logical next step, that when there was, in 2006, there was the possibility to ask subsidies as a laboratory. And that was just very much for us the right thing. And from then we have really structural subsidies and a space, very important, the space.
This space?
This space, where we had first other spaces, but now it's. I think it is really, the physical space is really very important.
Yeah, this is a really nice space.
Yes. This research started in 2015. And you could really look in festival programs, labels, also institutions. It was like such a tremendous under-representation. I thought there must be a good reason for this somehow. It was also what I heard here. I was also actually often very astonished that, I mean, I receive here at Kyoto, I receive proposals. And it was for many years, it was like I needed a looking glass for the women making proposals to me, a woman, you see. So like certainly 9 from 10 proposals came from men. And when this discussion about gender equity started, I really needed to look for them. I really needed to invite women, you know, like come or propose or do something. And then, no. And with much less confidence, women would come. But I think that maybe in hindsight, I'm also, if I'm really very honest, I was also maybe biased sometimes to certain ways of expression or to certain contents. So like female voice in certain styles I didn't like so much, you know, this sort of stuff. So I think there were many questions also for myself. Then it was something that many of the residents here had to have addressed, speaking, and then usually quite interestingly hidden. It was something that was not so openly addressed for many years. It was like more little remarks, you know, many prejudices also, like which I could understand in remarks. Oh yeah, female music, well, that's very soft, you know, this sort of stuff where you think, where do you get this from? And I think actually most of all it was probably really my own questions for myself, you know. I mean, for myself as a woman in the field, what do I really receive of discrimination? What do I also presume already from beforehand? Where do I discriminate myself, in fact, already, you know, before even entering the field? Also because I think that I have really... very many years I have always taken these very typically female roles, like among many other things, of course, organizing everything, looking that everybody is fine, you know, everybody's happy and that there's enough to eat, you know, this sort of stuff. And which actually is not a bad role. It's just the problem is not that the role is wrong, but that the valuing of it is wrong somehow. So these were many questions in myself, really, I think. And I think I enjoyed very much the first part, so I wanted to ask questions about this, I wanted to research about it, because I considered this to be a research laboratory. And because I'm not really a word person somehow, I collaborated with a dramaturg, you see, that say this, dramaturg, mm-hmm. A woman from the theater, Leen de Grave, she's also in the book. And so formulating these questions, I think that was a very interesting and, for me, illuminating process. What does this actually have to do with? It has to do with many things. It has to do with like how you see yourself. It has also to do with jealousy, with concurrence. How do you face these sort of things which are there in the field? What, it has to do with money. It has also to do with private situations, like do you have children or not? You know, this is of course a huge thing. And then how do you deal with this? Mm-hmm. For example, it was for me quite an experience that when I had children, I was just really not asked anymore. Because people thought already before, oh yeah, sure, she has no time. She made that choice, you see. So how do you deal with this towards yourself, but also do towards the others? These were, I think, questions very interesting to address. And then I did not really know what would come out. I mean, this was a super long survey, like some people had really invested many hours. And we got quite a lot of response, and these responses, they were really quite open, very honest, really generous, but then also full of ambiguities, and even the same person would say here that and there something else. So I can say, well, the book then, so we thought, what can we do with this material? And we thought, we make a book, because it's as if it's this book, you know, it's just like, it was very, very alive somehow. We sorted it in three chapters, or main chapters somehow. One is paradigm and otherness, which is like, that was very clear. People still feel this. There's this norm, and everybody else has to sort of navigate in between. The importance of the field then, how to navigate this field, how to deal with collaboration and finding jobs simply, and so. And then also the question about gendered music, and this, I think, that was a very fascinating discovery for me, that there is a connection. Well, I think what surprised me is actually how little we know. If we know more, you know, then also this sort of spell which comes from musical representation can be broken. You can then make really different choices, but informed choices somehow. You can determine yourself what you want to make, what you want to listen to, where you put criteria for quality, for example. And not anymore... Like, when I studied, sometimes I thought, I listened to some, you know, like Boulez or Stockhausen, and I think, I should like this. But actually, it did nothing to me. So I can now say, well, I just don't like it. It doesn't tell me anything. I'm much more addressing the topic without any complex. I'm also, well, speaking about it quite a lot. I'm actually quite astonished how much interest there is about people to hear about it. But I also, for making things, I am less in doubt, let's say. You see, I mean, I'm more... I don't care really so much if other people like it or not, or something, or if it meets any sort of standard. So, in fact, for example, when I'm composing, I consider myself really a hobby composer. I compose maybe once in 3 years, or in 3 years or something, uh-huh. And I really don't care. I can perfectly be happy now being a hobby composer, let's say.
And you wouldn't have felt that way before?
No. Before, I wouldn't have shown it. I would have made it, but not shown it. Yeah, because I was sure it wouldn't meet any sort of standards, and so who could be interested in this? I also think that the general climate is much more open for such considerations now than, for example, 10 years ago. Must be said also. So this is my personal decision, and I feel quite really sort of part of a movement or of a wave or of a paradigm shift, maybe even. But so it's both. I think it's myself, but it's also the others.
Yes, totally. Do you think you could discuss a bit your working relationship with Elian and how it perhaps informs your creative process?
In working with her, there was sort of a beginning of an answer to me what could be really maybe different if there could be a difference between men's and women's music. And I think it could be found... Of course, you cannot hear it, but it could be somehow maybe found in ways of collaborating. And also not always. It also depends very much on how you're socialized and all these sort of things. But how she is very generous about ownership, let's say. I think that was like, because she does not write anything. So this is a very important detail, I think. It's just really only by sharing mental images. So in the end, you could very well say, but who's actually making the piece? Is this she or is this he? Is this me? Is she the composer or am I actually making her piece? I have heard these discussions with the musicians. For me, this was never a question, and I really don't care so much. Also, this I think maybe in a way embodied somehow some of my questions. Very, very recently, somebody said to me, "Yeah, but she was not. She's also not the only one who concentrated so much on this sharing and on listening first, you know, and all these sort of things." And it's true that, of course, there were many more people, like Pauline Oliveros, like in the first place, probably even. And that I would think has also a lot to do with technology. That there was this technology at hand for that generation, which sort of allowed to make another music than this serialism and everything which built, which was officially somehow building on the old music. Because Eliane Radig, she says that she sees herself in classical music tradition, which I think was actually interesting to understand, that this is her, this is where she builds on. It's not as if she wants to create a new sort of discipline, which is sound art, not at all. She wants to have like a piece with a narrative, you know, with a beginning and an end, a development, even if it's very minimal. So that there is a sort of an answer to, or to sort of a sort of bypassing, I would say, of all this hyper-intellectualization which has followed serialism.
The score is essentially in your minds when you are working
mm-hmm.
together?
Exactly, yeah.
And you share this through verbal communication
mm-hmm.
and listening to each other?
So how it works is that she has, for this piece in any case that I'm part of, this last one, which is a series, which is in the meantime has many, like, I don't know, 70 pieces or something like this. And it's very important for her that she has met each performer first individually. And so this is, I would say it's not even like a composer-performer relationship, but even more maybe a sort of education. So you go, and she gives you the general image, which is this idea of everything is waves. So she always gives this idea of where she has seen once in a science museum all the waves of the world, let's say. I mean, everything is waves. This is also waves, and this glass is waves. We just only do not perceive them. So we perceive such a tiny, tiny little bit in the form of, for example, sound or also television, you know, light and so forth. But it's just a very, very tiny little bit. And she brings this to understand this sort of craziness or this realization, which you cannot really understand, I think, as a human. She brings this down to water, because water is also waves, and we all, this is tangible. It can be water in many forms. It can be a river, or it can be rain, or like the seaside, whatever, these things. And so this is individual. Each of us has an image, and we play the image. And then she says yes or no. And I think for me it's quite important how she listens. I guess that this is quite sort of a way to guide how she is very, very intense in listening. And I must also say that she's the only composer I've ever worked with who can be really moved, like listening to this. And this is like, it turns this relationship upside down in a way. I mean, I have worked with many composers where this is wrong and there and it's too loud and it's too, you know, like this, and it was always my fault. You know, even this notion of fault, this doesn't exist then anymore. And here it's really, she gives me, I give her, you know. This is this idea. Of course, she's also Buddhist, and I think this probably influences it quite a bit also. But it's also really like only this mental thing, that she tells an image, and she has maybe something totally different in her head than I do. But somehow, through this piece, through this sound, we can make it meet. She would not say that she's for gender equity or this sort of things. For her, this is, she acknowledges this, but she has not this feminist sort of fight like Pauline Oliveros had. Mm-hmm. And which for the generation I think is quite understandable also, because I think you were very easily then set aside as somebody fighting for feminism, unless you had your own community like Pauline Oliveros then. I think that it's definitely something that is now sometimes too much forgotten, that you need research time in art. Like, became so much focused on production, and by the way, I think it's also really really wrong to now, with all these austerity politics, the art fields everywhere, they say, but we are also producing money, you know, we're also producing value, and so I think it's such a wrong discourse, actually. And so an artist residency, yeah, it's like, why should artists not need time to experiment, reflect, and why should that not be also a very important and shareable thing? Because I guess that it's totally right that during an artist residency, what the artists do is not, it's not for a bigger public. It's not anything that it's immediately possible to understand what they are doing, let's say. But some of it is shareable, I think. And that's maybe what we would here sort of try to work on, that it's not only just a performance that you can afterwards participate to, or so, or even watch only, or listen. but that it's really, that the sense is also really in the making itself. So that could be nice, but it's, of course, it's not so easy to get that across, I think.
We know the struggle quite well.
Yeah. Well, I think that the value is like very difficult to determine immediately. I mean, I think the value is definitely knowledge and not money. So this here I would already start. And then, of course, the value is there for the artists themselves, let's say. And I think it would be a lie to say the value is there in the first place for the public. I think you cannot, it's like in the airplane where they say if there's oxygen loss, then you have to put on the mask first yourself and only then to your kid, let's say. Yeah. So the artist must be first well, her or himself, let's say, yeah, and knowledgeable and knowing what they do and so forth. And then the knowledge which comes out here, we cannot control. I really think that this, sometimes it's only years after, sometimes it's immediately, sometimes it's by, with one person that you meet, sometimes this one person speaks immediately to many other people. I guess that why would we want to quantify this? I mean, I understand that we need to quantify it because of the politics. But I guess that it's too easy to do it in such a way and not to address that it should also be another value. Although it's a good it's actually something that I'm now very, very much interested in too, from all this. Questioning about gender and the relation between, well, I mean, I think gender in relation to music became for me the relation between the music and a person or a situation, let's say. And I think that from here, what now I have really like, it was like beep beep, like this many times flagging up the word quality. It's also something which I have heard many times when I was in panels, for example, that people say to me, well, but like curators, huh? Like of big festivals, and so they say, well, when I do 50-50 quota, the quality of my program goes down. You know, this is like totun, huh? Like that thing. Like, okay, what do you say then? But also in many other, I have read quite a little bit also, and quality is something which comes up many times, and it means each time something different. So this isn't what I want to search for next, is what that does that actually mean, because it has lost its real meaning. It has lost the meaning of idiosyncrasy, of specificity, of character, material, or all these sort of things. And it became instead something to say this is good or bad, without even saying what is good and what is bad, but it's like the thinking in binaries. It's this old story. And so I think it would be like a good thing to also here to sort of scratch the surface and to say, where is actually the misunderstanding? I would like to know. And how can it be determined really so that it does justice to the music and not serves only to discredit some people and credit others.
88 megahertz up to 108.
You've got this frequency. We're going to call you CKUP. You've got this frequency, 98.3. That frequency is what you're picking up when you tune that radio.
Very impressive.
You can sit on the moon and look like they pick up CKUP, clear as a bell.
Fascinating. Your analysis seems logical.
CKUP is on the air.
Now, more than ever, the simplest gestures are our best protection to fight the virus. That's why we need to continue following basic health measures, such as keeping a 2-meter distance from others, wearing a mask and washing our hands regularly. Avoid travel and non-essential trips. And if you develop symptoms, be sure to get tested promptly and follow self-isolation guidelines. See all of the measures in place at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Let's continue to protect ourselves. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Hello and welcome to the first If You Got Ears DJ Frog special of 2021. How's it going? I hope you're all well. I hope you're all staying safe. You're listening, of course, to If You Got Ears on CKUT 90.3 FM. It's lunchtime. First up here, we have a submission from the nefarious DJ Georgie Porgy. Came into my inbox last night, and I knew I had to play it. This is Mescalito Part 1 and 2 by Bardo Pon. All right, I'm going to leave you with this for the next 40 minutes, and I'll check back.